So, I'm Rick Hansen, and this is February 26th, 2020. And once I stabilize my position here, I think the sound system will stabilize as well. So, as you may know, last year we explored the neurodharma practices. And this year, based on some input, quite a lot of input actually, from different people in terms of topics they're interested in, I hope to explore a combination of the classic Buddhist and elsewhere topic of impermanence, including the impermanence of our own body, death, the death of others, loss, or changing conditions, or the fact that rust never sleeps, including in terms of our own health. So at the same time, in a really interesting way, the more deeply we go into impermanence, the more deeply we find ourselves rested in a sense of what is stable, what is spacious, what is stillness, what is full of possibility, what is not yet conditioned. People talk about this in different ways, in different levels. The ground, the Buddha called it the unconditioned, the absolute, either within ordinary reality alone and perhaps extending beyond it. I'd like to explore the intersection of that which is transient and that which endures. It's really quite powerful stuff. And related to that, including in this election year, what everyone's preferences might be, how do we both recognize the transience of our efforts and their fruits, and the ways in which things do fall apart, while at the same time making the efforts that we can? Or, as I like to put it, and Neil Young stole this line, rocking in the free world. How do we bring them together, right? Right? And that, to me, very, very profound, profound couplet from T.S. Eliot, teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still. How do we do that? So that's what I hope to explore with you. And as a beginning of that, last week we began to engage the whole topic of the foundational awareness of the body, mindfulness of the body, including its impermanence, its vibrations, its dynamism, its endless changes, and respecting the emphasis, as I said earlier, that the Buddha placed upon that. So tonight, I'd like to read you some of the classic suttas or sutras about mindfulness of the body, and then slow it down and unpack some key lines and key words to make sure that they make sense to you and you relate to them in a grounded, felt kind of way, rather than the way in which I think sometimes we relate to this material is like a needlepoint on the wall, oh yeah, whatever, mindfulness, yeah, something like that. Like, it would be really real for us. Before we go any further, though, as a bit of a frame drawing on what we now know about neuroscience and what's actually happening inside us when we engage various mental practices, at a minimum, awareness of body sensations, a lot of research shows, tends to decrease internal verbal activity, which for many of us, much of the time, would be a wonderful relief. That voice yammering away in the back of the head, the one, as they joke, that says, what voice, Anyway, right? So just factually, when you bring attention into body sensations, particularly internal body sensations, that decreases activity in verbal centers of the brain, and in particular, pulls people out of the default mode network which gets active when we're ruminating. Now, some rumination is okay, some daydreaming is fine. We kind of space out, we let the brain actually reorganize itself to some extent. That said, a lot of people have a very wandering mind. Studies have shown that on average, a typical person's mind is just gone half the time, which means for those of you who are really collected here, there are many others who are like all over the place. And the more that a person's mind tends to wander, the more it tends to tilt negatively, partly due to the negativity of the bias of the mind, of the brain. So the point is that as we tune into the body, even when we actually tune in to sensations in the body that may be uncomfortable, our suffering tends to decrease right off the top. It's kind of a circuit breaker. Less of that internal yammer, less internal chatter, including self-criticism, and less negative rumination, anxieties, resentments, self-criticism, and so forth. Right there. Second, in particular, when we are aware of the body as a whole, so we might be focally aware of the arm reaching, the weight of the cup, while having a background sense, or a sense that we keep returning to again and again, of the body as a whole, an integrated whole, whole body. As we do that, again, neurologically, we tend to reduce activity in midline cortices, including in the default mode network, and we engage networks on the sides of our brain, especially the right side for right-handed people for whom the right side of the brain is involved, with a sense of holistic gestalt awareness. So when we engage the holistic gestalt sense of the body, we tend to engage these networks on the side of the brain, which reduce activity in the midline, thus less rumination, and more of a sense of being whole, being integrated, a sense of wholeness altogether. In the present, because these midline networks are very much involved with mental time travel, thinking about the future, thinking about the past. So you can just observe it yourself. When you focus on a sense of the body as a whole, that tends to bring you right into the present, reduces kind of abstract conceptualizing, and reduces the sense of self as well, which is very supported by activity in the midline of the brain. So that's very nice, right? So just body awareness per se tends to reduce verbal activity and rumination. And second, awareness of the body as a whole has additional benefits. So then to the Buddha, and I'll do this kind of briefly and then open it up, and we'll keep going with this. This is from the book Satipatthana. Satipatthana is translated typically as sati, as mindfulness in Pali, the language of early Buddhism. Patthana is translated variously as foundations, or arguably better perhaps as establishments. Where do we establish mindfulness? Where in us is mindfulness established? Either way. And if I were to recommend one book, one Buddhist-y book for a desert island, for a lifetime on a desert island, it would be this one, because it's so practical. And the Foundations of Mindfulness, or the Establishments of Mindfulness, is probably the most comprehensive, practice-oriented teaching of the Buddha. It's very thoroughgoing. And this particular translation and exposition of it by the German-born monk Anaglio, who has phenomenal command of the English language, is just really wonderful. So that said, I'm going to edit his translation a little bit on the fly here for kind of our purposes here. And then let's talk about it. So on one occasion, the Buddha was living in the Kuru country, and he addressed the people thus. Now, the people were mainly monastics in this kind of a setting, so you can frame what he's saying in that way. But anyone who has a sincere and dedicated interest in practice was encouraged to draw upon these teachings too. The Buddha did not have any secret teachings for the clergy, as it were, which is really quite radical in many ways, both in the context of the time and even today. So I'm going to alter the languaging here a little bit, even though technically people are addressed as bhikkhus, as monks. Okay? So here we go. So the Buddha said, "People, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of stress and suffering and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of Nibbana and enlightenment, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. So let's just kind of go right back to that. He says, this is the teacher. This is the one who's fulfilled the path himself. Not someone we worship, someone we respect as who's done the work. And then we judge the merits of what he teaches based on our own views and experience, not taking them on faith alone. This is the fundamental framing. Inside that framing, we can really appreciate expertise, right? Expertise. So the Buddha is offering his expertise. We judge it for ourselves. But in light of his own attainments, I'm really interested in what such an expert on enlightenment and living in peace with others and sustaining a deeply resilient, fundamental, unshakable well-being. I'm really interested in what this expert has to say. So he says, this is the direct path for the purification of beings. What does he mean by purification? It's not that we're tainted by sin. That's not the framework at all. It's a very pragmatic clearing away, filtering out, gradually releasing of what afflicts us, what hinders us, what makes us suffer. Sort of cleansing, clearing out. And clearing away what remains. What remains as what afflicts us, what clouds us, what burdens us, clears away, is the true nature that was always present. This is not about making ourselves something that we're not yet. It's about purifying ourselves so we can really ground in who we already are. Right there, in that little phrase, the purification of beings, the direct path, we have a deep teaching. So, it's for the surmounting or the transcending of sorrow, lamentation, grief. For the disappearance of dukkha, translated typically as suffering and discontent. For the realization of nibbana, taken all the way, leading to enlightenment. So I'd like to pause right there and explore with you why mindfulness, in particular applied to the body, could be applied to other things as well, but applied to the body could actually be, when routinely practiced consistently, could really be purifying and liberating. What do you make of that part so far? And do you have any questions about it? Yes, right there. Oh, the microphone maybe, if we have it? Okay, good, thanks, Bill. And we use the microphone here to bring everyone into the room so they can all hear it. And also to speed things up so I don't have to repeat questions or comments.
In the beginning, you were talking about stillness of the body and care, not care, be still. What about, I've noticed that when my body's moving, then my brain seems to have relaxed rather than when it's still. So I'm wondering about that.
I think that's a wonderful point. Now, of course, T.S. Eliot is not a world-class teacher of enlightenment. On the other hand, and it's a poem, so I think part of the sitting still is, as the Buddha, again, talks a lot, and there's language a little bit later on about being secluded from worldly concerns. That kind of, quote-unquote, sitting still. So it's, and also there's a lot of stress, and I'll get to it probably in weeks to come, about sustaining mindfulness while acting, while moving, while reaching, while standing, while lying down, while rolling over, while brushing, your daughter's hair, let's say. So I take your point also, which I think is very important for people, that particularly if a person, I think there are individual differences about this, but what I'm getting at is that oddly, sometimes We need to move to be calm, right? Action binds anxiety, for one. And also, I think there are many of us who need more stimulation to calm down the hunger of parts of the brain, mainly in the basal ganglia, which want a certain amount of stimulation all the time, depending on the temperament of the person. And I've known a lot of people who say, I'm only calm when I'm running, you know? Or dancing, or doing yoga, or things of that sort.
Yeah. Particularly,
yeah.
Because isn't that supposed to be mindful and using the body
at
the same time?
Yeah. So I think the point here is not to take the T.S. Eliot quote as an admonition to freeze. And I think there's been an interpretation of a lot of contemplative traditions, including the Buddhist tradition, as kind of like, you know, sit still, shut up, do what you're told. And this is not about that. That's not what the Buddha was teaching me. Okay, good. Thank you. Another person or comment so far? How about in the back there? All the way? Back? If you keep your hand up, Bill can then see you. Yeah, there we go. Thank you.
It's an extension of that question. You talked about how in the brain science, I can remember the question. There's something basically about how for humans, there's certain parts of the brain and certain types of stimulation. I think I lost the question, actually. What I was going to ask was the difference between young people and adults for that brain science to see if it's the same.
With regard to?
I'm trying to pull the content, but it basically was some kind of content around, I think, feelings of ease. It might have had to do with the actual feeling of, like, oh, it was actually about sensing the body. And how you were saying that tends to remove thought, experiences of suffering. Is that true when you're a young person too? And I imagine there's different blood chemistry going on and all kinds of things.
Boy, great question. And I don't think anyone knows a scientific answer. Just because we're really learning about this. The thing I would stress is awareness of the body per se, I'm not sure would reduce suffering. It tends to reduce chatter and the second darts that we throw ourselves, if you're familiar with that metaphor. Yeah, the first dart being, you know, the pain in your foot, the pain in your back, your shoes are too tight, something. But then the second dart is our tensing around it, or resisting of the physical pain, the first dart of the physical pain, or getting caught up in our thoughts about it, thoughts about the future, how can I bear this, or why don't other people help me, why doesn't my partner understand, you know, why isn't this pain medication acting faster, you know, and then we suffer more. So one thing that awareness of the body does naturally is it tends to short circuit a lot of that verbal ruminative activity. And in particular, it's this sense of things as a whole that has this oddly powerful effect in that it just kind of brings us right into the present. So the suffering that's related to the future and the past in our minds goes away and reduces the sense of self, which tends to reduce a lot of our suffering. And it's kind of a short step from awareness of the body as a whole to coming really close into the present. So you're kind of abiding right at the front edge of the windshield of consciousness before suffering has time to take root. Now, whether that's less common in younger people, young kids, teenagers, whatnot, wow, I wish I knew. I don't know at all. I will say, and I say this to teenagers sometimes, that stress will give you pimples. And the Buddha did teach that those who are really in the present, not worrying about the future, not preoccupied with the past, have a serene complexion. I'll leave it there. Maybe one more person, and then I'll read another little bit, and we could talk more. Shilpa?
Just,
yeah.
I'm thinking about the children.
Oh, yeah.
And the brain. So there's a woman, Susan Kaiser Greenfield, who teaches mindfulness to children. There's a woman, Susan Kaiser Greenfield, who teaches mindfulness to children. And when she started, just ran, I think, at like the YMCA, she would just sit there and have it available that kids could just come. You know, sit for a minute, sit for 5 minutes, sit for as long as they wanted. And kids would be and get interested and they'd come. What you found was that some of these children who were just almost the most overactive, maybe having the most trouble, that they, over time, you would see them calm down.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, when you look at, you know, development, that I think we start off, you know, when we think about our internal emotional needs, you know, we start with first needing safety, and then next needing that sense of love and belonging, and then next feeling that capacity that you can get these needs met. And so if we start with safety, you know, feeling our body is very grounding, and that grounding is very validating, which I think enhances that sense of safety. And so I think that if anything, for children, it's almost, it had the magnitude of the effect is probably far greater than it is for us as adults.
Oh, good. Thank you. I appreciate that, that point of view. Well, good. So we could probably spend a fair amount of time here, including just on that one word, purification. And so just before we go on, I want to mark the distinction between the pragmatic orientation of the Buddha to purification, to release, to abandoning afflictions, hindrances, clouding, and so forth. That's really different from the classic shame-based, finger-wagging, often Western, you know, often, frankly, gendered criticism of the body and of the life of the body and who people are. This is not about cleansing ourselves of original sin. Right? Purification is not understood in that way. It's very important to be aware of any tendencies towards self-criticism or self-shaming or scolding that get that co-opt what the wisdom of this idea of purification. And you might really ask yourself the two aspects of purification. What are you releasing? What are you releasing? And in the process of releasing, what are you concentrating? Right? What are you concentrating in yourself? To go together. For myself, a bit of a confession. It's a funny word, but you know the word to be irked by something? Irked? You know, sort of exasperated, you know, a little annoyed, a little frustrated, a little aversive, you know. Irked. It's kind of the beginning of trouble often, to be irked by something. So I've taken on a practice. It's kind of nice to decide, okay, I'm going to take on a practice. I've taken on a practice of being unirkable. I know it sounds like ants or something in Lord of the Rings, unirkable. What are irks or orcs? Irks. Anyway, but here's the thing. I'm not yet unirkable. I am irkable still. So in a weird way, because I want to become unirkable while being open and relational and engaged with life, right? When I notice that I am irked, I can welcome it. Thank you for the gift of being irked, because right there I can study on that and help myself become a little less irkable the next time. So I'm attempting to purify, if that's the word, gradually irkableness, irkedness, irking, irkishness, and so forth, and expand the range of, you know, what used to irk me that I'm no longer irked by. So it's nice to kind of work it out, right? You know that. So that's the purifying out of irkability, I guess. And what remains, you know, for me is a kind of a quality of patience and cheerfulness. And you know, one thing that really helps you be unirkable or not so irked is drawing real lines, you know, having real good boundaries and sticking up for yourself and taking care of your major needs so you're not irked by little needs being unmet. But that's a personal thing for me. And it might be an example for you. What's one thing this year you're kind of saying, you know, let that out, let that go. And what remains, what is concentrated or within you as you release all that? You might want to think about that. Okay. One more sentence, and then we'll kind of discuss it again. So what are the four foundations of mindfulness? There are three others, and you can check them out. I'm going to focus on the body here. Here, in regard to the body, you abide contemplating the body. So this is how to be mindful of the body. In regard to the body, you abide contemplating. Now, you can use that word in terms of meditation. It doesn't mean necessarily a kind of dualistic separation from the body. It means experiencing the body while remaining recollected, while remaining present. Okay? That's mindfulness. The root of the word for mindfulness is memory, to recollect. So to be recollected rather than mindless, that's the essence of mindfulness, to be present in a sustained, recollected way. Not watching the body sensations from 20 feet away, being in them while not being swept away by them. Right? So, in regard to the body, you abide contemplating the body, diligent. There's a work ethic here. Clearly knowing, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Let's unpack that and then hear what you have to say about it. So, abiding in touch with, I like the phrase in touch with the body, continuously, and the body as a whole, the whole body, continuously, diligent, sticking with it, coming back to it if you wander away, sticking with it. He doesn't say uptight, he says diligent, hanging in there. Clearly knowing, not spaced out, not drowsy, clearly knowing the body, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Now that's a little tricky, right? Because it's understandable to have desires that children be fed, or that our business thrive, or that, you know, someone do the dishes, not just you every night. Right? You want that. And discontent. It's kind of normal to have values and to, you know, not be pleased that, you know, things are not going according to your values. What he's talking here about in desires and discontent is being hijacked by them, carried away by them. Also in regard to the world, this is a contemplative tradition, and he's talking in part about the formal practice of meditation and meditative mindfulness of the body. But just I want to kind of flag a few of these key words and see what you make of them as we, you know, move to an end by 8:30. Diligent. What's your sense of diligence with regard to real-time mindfulness of your own body? Is that of value for you? Do you prioritize mindfulness of the body? Question. And also, can you be mindful of the body with a sense of not being swept away by pleasure and pain? Comments about that? Yes. Yeah. Microphone? That okay?
Yeah.
Great, thanks.
So I actually have two comments. The first comment is, I think the most valuable thing that I have learned in my contemplative life is the value of the pause. And I take the word diligence as the idea that I have to constantly practice that so I can interrupt myself. And I can actually feel, if I'm smart enough or conscious enough, as I am going down the superhighway to craziness, if I can just stop myself and say, I don't want to go there, and just pause. It's very simple. It's just the pause. So that's one thing. The second thing is, I'm Jewish. In the Jewish tradition, there's the idea of the breath, and you understand ruach, that it's a divine thing. So if, when you are just breathing, you understand that breathing comes from some divine element that you have in you. I actually find that very calming.
Oh, good. Thank you very much.
So those are my two things.
Great. Oh, here we go. Thank you, Bill. Maybe another question? So how about first you, then I want to make sure I get to this side of the room. So over there, if you keep your hand up. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, thank you. Mm. Does any of this consider the concept of optimism or pessimism, or is that tripping on the future, that central part?
Okay.
I find that something that, like, optimism doesn't leave me thinking about certain things. I guess when I'm just meditating, I'm not in any kind of zone that would consider that, but
yeah, so I'll just speak to that kind of briefly. I won't be able to tie it into mindfulness of the body per se, right? But briefly, people use these words in different ways. What the Buddha really, really emphasized was recognizing whatever's true. And so optimism or pessimism are about the future, right? In a sense, they're about our appraisals of the likelihood of various events and what the impacts of those events will be. It's those two. And we could say that optimists tend to distort the probability and the impact of events in a happy direction, and pessimists tend to distort their view of the probability and impact of events in a negative direction. Both, in a sense, are delusional, a little bit. There's a little bit of a distortion, by definition. A realistic appraisal would be accurate about the odds of something happening and its actual impact and how well one would handle that. Now, it's said that pessimists tend to see reality a little more clearly, on the one hand. On the other hand, it's really easy to develop a sense of kind of what Martin Seligman coined the term learned pessimism, where people become pretty grim in their takes on things, and they tend to overestimate threats and underestimate opportunities. On the other hand, there's a way in which what's called defensive pessimism can actually be helpful for some people, in that because people are very vulnerable to feeling disappointed and let down, if they go, they learn to acquire a strategy of coming into situations with a kind of preemptive strike of lowering your expectations so they won't be so disappointed or frustrated. On the other hand, that can create sometimes a self-fulfilling sort of prophecy, because if you go in with low expectations and even almost trying to make the shoes drop because you figure they're both going to drop anyway, you know, I know you're going to let me down, so why don't we just get it over with, all right? You know, then it tends to happen that way. So I would just sort of say about that. And I think both are okay. It's kind of helpful to know a little bit which way you tilt. I tend to tilt a little optimistically, and my wife tends to tilt a little pessimistically. And like most pessimists, she thinks I'm stupid. And like most optimists, I think she's clueless. But, you know, but we live together. So anyway, I'll just leave it right there, okay? But it's helpful to really ask yourself, you know, the great Dharma question from Dr. Phil, right? So how's that working for you? You know, better, and then you tell. Okay, that's what I just leave it at that. Over there, one last question.
Comment,
yeah.
And something that I felt was actually kind of a turning point for me during meditation, you know, I'd often sort of sit there, you know, get settled in, there's an itch, I scratch one itch, and then there's a few more, like sort of that sort of paying attention to the body, and then sort of giving in to this itchiness. Eventually it would sort of settle and go away, and then I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to scratch. It's like, what the heck is happening on my cheek? You know, it's this massive sensation of this itch, and but sort of once I pass through that, I'm like, and then the next time that itch is there, I'm like, it'll go. That's what an interesting itch that is, and just sort of that experience, and sort of a micro irk.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. You know, same sensations, but the frame is very, very different. Yeah, thank you. So I had two suggestions for practice in the week to come. And first and foremost, the Buddha was about practice. You know, he applied his expertise really to practice. The ideas are in the service of practice. The point is the, you know, gradual reduction of suffering and the gradual welcoming and growth of happiness, love, and inner peace and wisdom. Right? So in that spirit, I invite you to be diligent, if you like, in regard to more continuous awareness of the feeling of breathing. Many times a day, returning to the sensations of breathing and seeing what it's like as you do regular activities, as you drive, can you be aware of breathing? As you talk, can you be aware of breathing? As you do dishes, as you walk, can you be aware of the feeling of breathing? It's a really wonderful practice. I'll talk a little more about the Buddha's specific instructions about mindfulness of breathing next week, but just setting it for yourself, like, okay, when I leave here tonight, I'm going to try to remain aware of breathing. And when my mind wanders, I'm going to bring it back. Continuity of mindfulness of breathing. Second thing, which is incredibly rich to explore, is to be aware of the sensory components of being irked by things, or wanting things, or having emotional reactions to other people. What are the, as Antonio Damasio, I believe, coined the phrase, the somatic markers? And what's very interesting is to become aware of these body sensations, the tightening of certain muscles that underlie our reactions to stuff. And it's very often these sensory motor patterns of sensation and action, in other words, tensing or relaxing, that anchor our problematic reactivity. And, you know, as a therapist know, getting in touch with that underlying somatic layer is really useful. It's often necessary for really becoming free of these reactions, and it's really helpful to become aware of it. So the next time you're irritated by something, I mean, I don't know if you'll get through the next week without ever being irritated or irked, but maybe you won't be so happy as to be entirely free. You know, what's going on in your body? Or if you feel hurt, or if you feel intense about something, or you want something, or you're forceful about something, or you watch the results of the South Carolina primary and shake your head at the television or some of the commentary on the television, boom, right there. What's the underlying sensation track of the music of your experience? That's a second real encouragement for this week. Then we can talk more about it next week. So let's just sit for a minute, recollect the body, let it all sink in. Truly, thank you for your practice. It serves many people. It really does. Your personal practice. Thank you. See you next week.